Washington has some big promises to go ahead with or to go along with some big problems. Here are some of the economic fixes that you are likely to see at least talked about, though my guess is actually fixing them, well, that will be a whole nother story. You're listening to Simply Money. I'm Nathan Bacharach, flying solo this evening. President Joe Biden has promised that he will forgive student debt. Sounds good. Also promises to lower the age by which you could then get Medicare and will be sending out or hopes to send out more stimulus checks. So tonight, I will humbly try and go through the economic challenges that we are likely to see both parties having to try and fix, because this is not a you fix it and I'll decide whether to vote on it or not. This is something that involves everybody, and it's near and dear to all of your hearts, because if, in fact, we are going to solve some of these bigger problems, these are problems that go, retirement is not a Republican or Democratic issue. It's our issue. The Congressional Budget Office has weighed in on some of the problems facing Social Security. Let's face it, Social Security has a math problem. The trust fund is going to run out, it's going to take in, I should say, $823 billion in 2021. It's projected to have to spend $949 million. So it's going to pay out $949, it's going to take in $823. When you were young, you would have said, looks like you're broke. But in this case, as you get older, you don't want to tell people you're broke. So you say, look, I got a cash flow problem. I'm wondering, could you help me out a little? So Social Security has got a cash flow problem. Now, before you say it's bankrupt now because it's running at a deficit, I would tell you Social Security is backed up by government bonds that have been issued by the government that are in the trust fund. And those government bonds are backed by the taxing power that the government has to tax you. This is non-negotiable. So if you meet me on the streets and go, hey, Nathan, Social Security is going bankrupt, I'll go, no, not unless government decides to no longer tax all of you. Otherwise, you're going to continue to go to work. You're going to continue to have taxes taken out of your account. It's going to be backed up by U.S. Treasury bonds, which are AAA and the best in the world. Nobody's messing with that now. So the question becomes, how do you make up the shortfall? And the Congressional Budget Office estimates the tax revenues would need to increase by 2.6% just to match the outlays for 2021, meaning instead of roughly, in I'm going to use round numbers, 15% of your compensation between the 7.5% that you pay and the 7.5% your employer pays, you'd be paying 9%, they'd be paying 9%. You know, that's going to get you to roughly the number we need to have the system on a pay-as-you-go basis. So where are the options? Listen, there's not a whole lot of options here. You can cut the benefits. You can do nothing. You can means test it, which is mean, but it says, hey, you're doing well. Nathan, you followed all the rules. You did everything you told all the listeners to do. You financially have gotten yourself to a point where you've got independence. So you're not getting Social Security. Maybe we'll give you back what you put in, but that's all you're getting back, and that's means testing. The other thing we can do is we can raise taxes. And we could also raise the benefit age, or we could do a combination. Now, President Biden has suggested repealing the income tax cap to over $400,000. So no matter what you make, no matter how successful you've done, you will pay your share of Social Security. This would, in effect, be a tax on the wealthy. Any tax increase, of course, is going to face some pretty significant opposition in that in the Senate, which, as you know, has got these little razor thin control by Democrats. So maybe, by the way, those people who make over $400,000 probably give a disproportionate amount of money to the political system, you think? And so that really means at the end of the day, I'm not sure that's going to be the solution. Keep in mind that the Social Security primary insurance age, or the age where you get your biggest benefit unless you wait till age 70, that's been progressively going up. And yet it was 65 when Social Security started in the 30s. Now you figure life expectancy, when they had a retirement age of 65 for Social Security, the average mortality for a man at that point was 62. You could say that Franklin Delano Roosevelt was a big cynic and said, here's a benefit. Let's see if you can live to collect it. Well, we've blown way past that. Average age now for a man and a woman is somewhere between 78 and 82. And if both of you and your husband and your wife make it to 65, there's a 50% chance one of you makes it to age 90. In my family, I know exactly who that's going to be. Marcy, thank you very much. So Social Security's got a funding problem. That's got to be dealt with. Medicare has a funding problem. The Congressional Budget Office estimates that Medicare's Part A trust fund will be insolvent, and this one's going to happen right when we're having some elections. This will happen in 2024. This, of course, has been accelerated by COVID. And Part A is hospital insurance. And by cutting reimbursements to hospitals, well, if that was a thought somebody had for making Medicare work better, that's probably not going to work because COVID has stretched the hospital system to the max. The average couple, if you make it to 65, the two of you, you're going to need at some point $280,000 to $300,000 out of pocket. These are the current estimates. And you'll see it. And I will make, as I'm heading into retirement, I'll make Medicare real simple for you. If you can afford it, you just go to Part G, and you'll get Part A, and then you'll get Part G. And here's the other interesting thing about Medicare supplements. By law, they are all the same. If you line up a Blue Cross and United Healthcare and somebody else, and you're looking at a Plan G, whoever's Plan G is the cheapest, that's the one you take. All right? I spent some time with a very wonderful Medicare specialist. His name is Daryl Dick. And I tell you, in 5 minutes, he said, boom, boom, boom. I was like, wow, I thought this was going to be a long conversation. He goes, nope, if you can afford it, you go to G. And they're all the same. Get the cheapest. So good information I pass on to you as I am about to exit into the next phase of my life outside of Simply Money. You're listening to Simply Money. I'm Nathan Bacharach as we discuss some of the economic challenges that will be facing the administration and President Biden, and that all will be taking place whether they like it or not. Now, a fundamental problem in the healthcare system is really the disconnect between cost and price. And so I've always liked this idea. I really appreciate that the administration and the President Trump said, hey, let's take the 300, and making it simple, let's take the 300 most typical procedures and let's publish the price. Now, that's great, except when you've got a broken leg and you're in an ambulance on the way to the hospital, I don't think your next question out of your mouth is going to be, do me a favor, could you right turn and go, don't go to Jewish Mercy. Would you please go up to Bethesda North? Because up at B North, the x-ray costs $200 less. No, that's not how it's going to work. But it's a nice thought. But what would be the incentive for you when you have a choice and the orthopedic surgeon says, well, Nathan, I want to take a look at those hips that you've been complaining about, so why don't you go down the hall and get an x-ray? You don't look at the doctor and go, okay, doc, just one question. I know you probably own that machine and are making some money on that, but by the way, how much is that x-ray going to cost? The doctor will probably look at you like, that's not my job. I'm here to give you good health care. Uh-huh, right, because they don't run businesses. No, sure they do. So the point is, you don't shop, in most cases, for medical services. If you were going to shop for medical services, well, then maybe if there was an incentive for you to want to figure out, okay, hold that thought, doctor, because I'm going down because, you know, I love watching, listening and watching the Sunday night football. And, Chris Collinsworth is such a nice guy. I'm going to ProScan. Now, by the way, wouldn't it be funny if the doctor said, oh, wait a second. Well, before you go to ProScan, I can match that price. Then you would go, well, sure. But still the question remains. Why are you going to want to have the discussion with the doctor about two different providers? Because what's in it for you? I mean, if you save money for the insurance company, what are they? Are they saying thank you? Now, I was talking to an individual one night who said, yeah, my insurance company does that. My question would be, why don't all insurance companies do that? Wow. Give me, the consumer, an incentive. Because what I know right now on the work site is that every year your employer, if you've got insurance through your employer, they're talking to their benefits consultant, which is the nicest way I've heard to say insurance agent. And that agent says, well, it's going up by 2%, by 4%, by 6%. And then the employer goes, wonderful. How am I going to pay for that? Or put another way, the conversation usually gets to, all right, what portion will my employees get the opportunity to pay? And then how much am I, the employer, going to have to pay? Now, some businesses pay a lot of it or all of it. Some businesses say, hey, I'm paying for Nathan, but Marcy and Ariel and Micah, no. You have to pay for the family coverage, or I won't even pay for the family coverage if your wife works somewhere, or husband or wife works somewhere else, because they got to go get their coverage from someone. And maybe at best I'll take the kids, who, by the way, are very, in most cases, will be very low risk. But this is the kind of a conversation that takes place. And so tell me what's, you know, the joke always has been my favorite radio station is WIIFM. No, you can't find it on the dial. It's what's in it for me. So if maybe when we take a look at the insurance issues, we were to say, all right, so what's in it for me? If I go down the street, using my example, and I go to ProScan and I get my x-ray, I get my MRI, whatever the case may be, and then I go to the doctor with that disc or that file, or they send it. I don't care how it works. And I save the insurance company $200 for doing that, assuming you could ever understand the real price in the first place. Then tell me, does that reduce my deductible? Do I get part of the savings? So I say, well, if we save $200, can I get $100 off my deductible? So instead of having a $500 deductible, it's a $400 deductible. And if I become a really good consumer, can I get it down to zero? Now, maybe when I leave Simply Money, what I should do is go into the healthcare business and be a healthcare advocate on behalf of this proposal. I would call it the split the pot or not initiative. Talk to it. Maybe if you know a congressman, talk to him about it. Rob Portman, you've been on the show often enough. If you're listening or somebody knows him, let's try that one off for size. Give the consumer. Because if you had 200 million people looking at their bills and assuming for a moment that the 300 prices or the price of 300 items, as now we can determine that to be the most often provided and the most, I hate to say popular, but the most often transacted. And we could figure out, we had 150 eyeballs looking at this saying, hey, I know how to cut the cost here. Well, maybe we could get our GDP from 18% of GDP for healthcare to 17% of GDP. That money goes somewhere else. And by the way, wherever it goes is better than going to a hospital for your health. We'll continue to talk about the problems and the challenges facing the administration and some of the things that you can do in subsequent Friday editions of Simply Money. You're listening to Simply Money here on 55 KRC, the talk station. You're listening to Simply Money. I'm Nathan Bachrach. Amy Wagner's out today. I'm flying solo. You're paying for your kids. You're helping your aging parents. Does this sound like you? How do you save for yourself in the middle of all that? We'll talk about that just ahead at 6:43. I personally don't want to go anywhere near a grocery store because I've seen all manner and fashion of wearing a mask, except any of the ones that my doctor friends would suggest is actually effective. So please cover your noses, but not wanting to take the chance that I'm going to have to engage somebody and say, you know, that's sort of like walking around with your zipper down and stuff hanging out. That's just not really going to be helpful for either of us. I get aggravated, so it's easier for both you and me if I stay in my car and I just get my Kroger delivery right there, and that's where you're always going to see the Simply Money mobile. So I don't want to go anywhere near a Kroger. Kroger's figured that out, so now we have Krogo. And Krogo is a smart shopping cart with a built-in scale and a camera. So this allows me to go shopping and then check out from their cart. All right, this is kind of interesting. And it will also return items for you. It'll take them out of the cart. In other words, this is robo-shopping, which might be the only way that I'm going to wind up getting the tomatoes that I like without having to worry that somebody else is going to squeeze them for me. So are Kroger employees finally going to have to chase 16-year-olds around the store who throw beer in their Krogo carts? Maybe. Right now, Kroger is testing the cart in Madeira. I would love to see that. If anybody has pictures, please send them over to us. That would be great. We'll see how this expands. The bad news, of course, is that maybe less people would be needed for shopping, though somehow I kind of doubt that. Every Sunday, the Allworth Advice column runs in the Cincinnati Inquirer. It starts running today at Cincinnati.com, and as we preview it, the first question came to us from Terry in Batavia. She says, my dad, he's 85, recently got a phone call from someone claiming to be with Social Security and told them that his number had been compromised. His number has probably been compromised, but that's a different discussion. Now, he hung up, is what Terry goes on to say, before they could get any personal information out of him. She is just wondering, should she report this scam to someone? Well, yeah, I guess you can, but good luck, because it pops up so often. So the general rule of thumb, whether it's Social Security, whether it's a phone call saying your grandson is now in jail in Mexico and we need to, you need to wire money to make their bail so they can get back across the border, as if somehow this is a reverse version of Jesse James and Billy the Kid and it's the Wild Wild West and Texas is still part of Mexico, you know, which would be the other great scam that's out there. The answer would be, thank you very much. Listen, I'm busy right now. Let me call you back. Because Social Security has got a published number. And you call that number, and you and I have called Social Security. I'm going to tell you something. They start asking you questions before they're going to engage you at all. And believe me, by the time you're done, you're pretty well convinced that the NSA has got information on everybody. I'm making a joke. But they know enough about you from all of your past tax returns and everything else. They can ask you questions, and they'll figure out real quick whether you is you or whether you is who knows who. At which point then, you know, you'd have they or whoever's on the phone would have a different problem. And same thing with credit cards. Somebody calls you up and says, your credit card's been compromised. I can't tell you how many times I get a text message saying, hey, Nathan, your card's been compromised. And they might even have the last four digits. I don't care who texts me information like that. I do the same thing. I say, thank you very much. I hang up. I take the phone number on the back of my credit card, and I call up, and I ask. And so I've gotten this notice a couple of times, and I've called up, and sure enough, yeah, they said, yeah, in fact, your card has been compromised. We can usually figure out one or two or three merchants where that's likely to have taken place. Just think about how often you give your phone number or your credit card number out one way or another. And so I call up, and they go, yeah, that's it. Or they'll go, no, Mr. Bacharach, everything seems to be just fine. Don't know who was telling you had a problem with your card, but seems fine to us. So always make sure you are initiating the call. Don't take the toll-free number that they tell you, because I can promise you right now, that would simply mean that you're calling their masked toll-free number. That won't do you any good at all. Next question comes from HT from Florence. She says, I've been working from home since last March, and I've had to buy some supplies and some new furniture for my office. And my employer says, sorry for your bad luck, but no, we're not reimbursing you for that stuff. Can you deduct these expenses from your taxes? Well, first off, they would go as unreimbursed business expenses. Easy for me to say. Here's the real deal. You start claiming an office in your house, and I promise you, that would almost be as good as putting on a nice big red cape when you walk into a bull ring and going, hi, I'm here. Shall we dance? The bull is probably going to take it a little differently than the way you may have meant it. Same thing when it comes to home office deductions. There is a place, Schedule C, you can put it down. But look, unless you're going to be able to itemize, the chances are you're not going to be able to deduct it. So the question, as HT is suggesting, is first have the conversation with your employer. But if you're going to deduct it, and this is the time when taxes become not a do-it-yourself at home proposition, but instead a call up a tax professional, which I'm all for, by the way, make sure that someone else has said to you, yeah, I think that probably works. You could probably you could do that. But don't start getting cute these days with home offices, because unless you can say that study that's, you know, everybody is using all day long is used exclusively for the purpose of business, which will be very difficult for you to justify. If you want to invite an audit, and I certainly would not recommend that, that's an easy way to do it. So what do you need if someone you love wants to give you some stocks or bonds in their will? Is that a good idea? We'll talk about that just ahead at 6:34. You're listening to Simply Money here on 55 KRC. We are the talk station. You'll listen to Simply Money. I'm Nathan Bacharach along with Amy Wagner. Recently, our guest was Morris Miller. He runs Zenex Company. That's the folks that create the robot. We had a very robust conversation. We're going to continue picking up right where we left off with Morris, talking about all kinds of things having to do with the future of medicine, how to kill germs, and just what exactly his company is doing. You saw the future a long, long time ago when you started this company. Now, as you look forward, and with the first financial life support bill was $2.2 trillion. Of that, 7.8% of it is going to the healthcare systems, and yet healthcare represents 16% of our gross domestic product, some of all of our goods and services. So please tell me what we're missing as we move forward to make sure this doesn't happen again, when it sounds, at least on its face, like we're cutting the numbers short in the one area where we should be expanding them.
Yeah, I think we've always known that if you eat right, if you exercise, you can prevent sort of maladies to your health. And it's really the same thing in all of these facilities. If we can do an ounce of prevention, pound of cure, that's the trite saying. And yet, if we can go in and consistently disinfect, I think at the time I saw you back in 2014, I said the hospitals that are using this have dropped their infection rates 50 to 100%. That's what they report. When they do that, the cost of delivering healthcare really drops. So preventing the infections is a lot less expensive than treating them. That's where I think it's going to go.
And is that where you think money needs to be getting spent? I mean, as we look at stockpiles, we look at face masks, we look at face shields, everything else, what are the kinds of things that we need to be spending the money on the public money that we're investing?
So first of all, PPE, personal protective equipment to protect our healthcare workers, extremely important. If you look abroad, I've had people almost cry to me on the phone because doctors and nurses, they're putting their and the housekeepers, they're putting their lives on the line to care for these patients. You need to have PPE, and then number two thing is you have to disinfect these environments. This is one of the most virulent viruses we've ever seen, really, in modern history. It goes everywhere, all over the hospital, and you have to, on a daily basis, consistently get rid of it, and that's exactly what the Zenex robots do. That's what the LightStrike robots do.
So you're building robots that kill the germs that none of us ever want to even know the name of, least of all ever encounter. Tell me about the environment, though, at your company where you're building these, because if anybody's got a safe working environment, I'm figuring it's you.
Yeah, this morning I walked in. Everybody has on face masks. I'm kind of with the president here. I'm not wearing a face mask, at least right now, because it would just muffle my voice. But everybody's got on face masks. Everybody's observing proper social distancing. And even in the manufacturing plant where we're building the robots, everybody has proper spacing. We're being very careful in terms of washing hands. If anybody even has a cough, we're kind of looking at them like, okay, maybe you need to go quarantine. So we're exercising those same things. The other thing we're doing is we actually use our robots. So if three or four people are in a meeting room and they have a meeting together, right after we leave, that robot comes in. We spend the 10 minutes it takes to disinfect the room. And we think that by being consistently really following our own, this isn't like the cobbler's children have no shoes. We're making sure that we're doing the same level of disinfection that we're advising to the government and all the hospitals.
So currently you're putting these things in hospitals. Can you imagine a division of your company in a day when there's a smaller robot maybe that doesn't cost what these cost, that goes, you would buy, and so people would advertise and say, hey, come to our place to do business because we've just disinfected it with a Zenex robot?
Look, right before the Olympics got canceled, I was asked for a 2,000 robot bid. So it's clear that it's coming to me. We were in the paper on a Sunday, big national paper, because hotels have been adopting it. I've been in conversations with cruise ships since 2014. I spoke to the CEO of Carnival Cruise Line back then. I think now they'll have a different view on it. Similarly, some of the top gyms in the country where people are actually going in there sweating, we've talked to them about protocols. How do you do it? And then finally, we've been contacted by the airlines. How do we disinfect the planes? We know how to do all that, and we know exactly how the robots should be built for those specific purposes.
Yeah. So let's talk numbers for just one second as we wrap up. Tell me about the numbers on what a machine costs to a hospital, and then what is the return for any facility that buys one of these things?
Yeah, great. The So generally, the retail price, let's call it, it's a little bit more, but call it $100,000 just to make it easy. And when you amortize that over the useful life of the machines, I'm constantly explaining to hospitals or other facilities, it's about $100 a day. So for $100 a day, you can actually have a disinfected facility, you know, with regards to the rooms that it's going to treat. And then on a per room basis, it costs, if you only did 10 rooms a day, it's $10 a room, but most of the hospitals do 60, and therefore it's approximately $2 a room for them to properly disinfect it. And that's what we kind of gauge. We go, look, you're going to get 12 to 60 rooms a day. Let's look at the size of your facility and plan the robots appropriately. And at $2 a room, you don't really need to do a lot of thinking to do proper disinfection for your customers or patients.
Listen, if I'm the patient, I'm pulling that loose change out of the cushions of my couch and saying, would you do me a favor? Please bring that machine in every night before I go to sleep so you can keep the place bug-free. You've been listening to Simply Money. Our guest has been Morris Miller. He's the CEO of Zenex Corporation. They make a robot that you are going to want to make sure at some point is everywhere you would like to be, particularly in environments like the ones that we are living in now. Morris, thank you very much for your time. Wish you all the best of luck. And I know the future, unfortunately, for many reasons, will be bright for you and your company. You've been listening to Simply Money here on 55 KRC, the talk station. You're listening to Simply Money. I'm Nathan Bacharach, along with Amy Wagner. Who pays? This is the question of the coronavirus age. Who pays for what on a virtual date? Or why is it that Nathan is so glad he's been married for 32 years and doesn't have to be involved in this scene? We'll talk about that just ahead at 6:53. We suggest one thing to do to reduce your stress level during insane times. Don't look at your 401k, but what do we know, Amy? You're peeking.
You're looking anyway, and I have to fess up about this because when this all started back in March, I didn't check it for a long time. And finally,
last week,
I thought, okay, I've calmed down. I've gotten used to this new norm. I need to have this information. I'm going to go ahead and look. But I had prepared myself for it, and I also knew I wasn't going to touch it. So understand, you're going to get in there, and it's not going to look like it did before.
No.
But here's some good news out of it. The average 401k balance actually had $91,000 in it during the first quarter. The average IRA had $98,000. The average 403b had $75,000. And people had started putting a little more money in during the first quarter of this year before this happened. So it kind of starts to show us that maybe we're not completely freaked out about what's going on here.
Well, you may not be freaked out about what's going on here, but, you know, as we have looked at businesses, Macy's would probably be the poster child for a business that you would say, I'm not sure they were in such good shape to begin with, but whoa, now, good luck, kids. Hope you make it through. See you to the other side. When you look at a balance of $91,000 in a 401k, and that's an average, that means it could be four people with $1 million, and then another 10 people who have 10 or 15 or 20,000. The question you should ask yourself is, at the rate you've been saving and the rate you are saving, where are you likely to be by the time the next once-in-a-lifetime event comes around, since they seem to happen every 10 to 15 years? Where will you be if you happen to be retiring, and where will that balance of yours be? Because balances aren't going up right now. Average balance on a 401k dropped about 19% last quarter. The average IRA, that's a 401k balance. Average IRA was down 14%. And the average 403B, and that's people who were working for nonprofits, hospitals, or educational institutions. Their accounts also down, round numbers, just shy of 20%.
And truly, though, going into this Q1, more people were putting money into the 401k and your IRA. So
and
we kind of had the winds at our backs coming into this recession. 15% of 401k savers actually increased how much they were putting in. Also a 10% increase in the average IRA contribution. So we came from a time where people felt relatively good about their financial situation. So hopefully, you know, the advice that we've been giving you, which is the same as what we would tell you about your face, right? The doctors say keep your hands away from your face. We would say keep your hands away from your 401k.
That's right.
And if you can get through it, you know, and sometimes it takes more strength than you have as an individual. You know, I've talked to a number of advisors at Allworth as we've been going through this. And one thing that they have said is the number one thing that is making people make decisions is fear. In this unprecedented time, how much worse can it get? How much worse can my balance get? And that once they were able to talk through the situation with them and provide some historical perspective and talk to them about what's really going on, most people who were on that ledge, right, on that cliff saying, I'm going to take all my money out and I'm going to put it under my mattress, walked back. They just need a little help in walking back.
And as we discuss what you should or shouldn't be doing as you take a look at your 401k during the age of coronavirus, understand a couple of things. A loss is not is not permanent unless you get out and then just stay out. Then it becomes permanent. And keep in mind that you'll know that you have a substantial you've saved well when all of a sudden you look at your balance and then you say to yourself, "Oh my goodness, I'd have to work a year to make that much money back." Well, you're not being asked to do that. What you're being asked to do is be patient enough to let this thing work through so that then all of a sudden, as fast as you lost, I don't know, a half a year's worth of salary or a year's worth of salary or a month's worth of salary, whatever it is that was the decline in your balance, you will find it might have taken 2 or 3 or 4 weeks to lose it, and it might take 6 months to get it back, but you ultimately will get it back. And keep in mind, the one most important thing that you should have been doing, we have been doing it with the folks that we work with because we know how important it is, and that's rebalancing your investments. Just as they tell you, you want to get good wear and tear out of your tires, rebalance your tires. How many of you actually do that? I'm going to say, and I'm in this group, every once in a while I look at my tires and go, oh, wow, that one's going bald. The other three are fine. What's going on here? Didn't rebalance, didn't rotate the tires. You can do the same thing with your investments.
Rebalancing is something, too, that a lot of you don't think about until things do get bad. In fact, we came from, an 11-year-long bull market where it seemed like you could do no wrong. We had clients who are in their 80s and 90s calling and saying, hey, you know what? I don't need bonds anymore. Look how well my stock is doing. Just put me 100% in stock. What if they had gone through with that, right? What if we had said, probably not a good idea, and here's why, and explained it to them?
Then they would
think
be not
about,
happy.
Yeah, think about how much of a loss they would have taken during this time being 100% in stocks. You really have to figure out a number of things, right? What is your risk tolerance? How far away are you from retirement? What are your needs? What are your goals? Those kinds of things. And all of those things together are very personal. But once you figure that out, that's going to give you how much stock, how much bonds you should be in. It's going to help you figure out what the right formula is for you. If you're not there, now's the time to rebalance.
And rebalancing is the disciplined approach of sticking with your initial strategy. So here's what happens. Let's say you started out and you were 65% in stocks, you were 35% in bonds. All of a sudden, by the middle to the end of February of 2020, you were looking at your investments going, oh, look how well we are doing. Had you noted your allocations, you might have found, and I'm going to blow up these numbers a little just for purposes of illustration, that you were 75% stocks and 25% bonds because, oh my, your stocks had done really well. So as a percentage of your strategy, all of a sudden now, you were about 15 to 20% more exposed to the stock market than your original strategy had been of being 65-35. Rebalancing would say when you notice that, and before we knew there was a virus, and before we knew anything else, your advisor should, and we do this. This is what, in my opinion, separates professionals from faux advisors. So we said to the clients, maybe we should peel this back. So what happens? You sell some of the stocks that, yes, have grown, and they're high in value at that point, and you invested them in what? Bonds, which weren't paying very much at the time, but we kept telling you were shock absorbers, and so you were selling high and buying low, which is the opposite of the thing you learned in kindergarten probably, which is to buy low and sell high. And all of a sudden, you start to see the benefit of a systematic rebalancing. I can tell you as an example, we've done this twice in the last 60 to 90 days. It's had a tremendous impact on making sure that you get your allocations back where you want them, and you take advantage of selling winners when they're up and buying things that are down when they're down. And then you find all of a sudden bonds have been rallying, stocks went down, and wow, wasn't that a good move? So if you're not rebalancing, if the people you're working with are not consistently and on a disciplined method and manner rebalancing, that's a good criteria by which to say, maybe I need to find someone who can actually do that for you. Simple Money Point, your 401k is feeling the pain. Take control by rebalancing. Consider a rollover if you're out of work now and you have control over those funds that until recently have been a part of your employer's plan, and get your goals and needs right. If you love someone, send them groceries. Really? Virtual dating. I can't wait to hear what Amy's got to say about this. You're listening to Simply Money on 55 KRC, the talk station. You're listening to Simply Money. I'm Nathan Bacharach along with Amy Wagner. After 32 years of marriage, I'm so far away from this, Amy, but virtual dating, and now the question for the ages, who pays? Well, first off, how do you even touch something? But talk to me about dating in the age of coronavirus.
Well, I mean, and as someone who is single, I can tell you I have not tested these waters. But I know that there's a lot of people out there who are. And, you know, you're not supposed to be going out. So how are you going to connect with people? Well, some of the same apps that you've been using before, but now you're doing virtual dates because there's no bars, there's no restaurants, there's no drinks that you can meet up for. Tinder has actually issued an in-app card encouraging social distancing and actually made something called Tinder Passport, which means before you were going to want to connect with only people in the tri-state because you were actually wanting to date them. Well, now you can actually connect with people wherever have interests like yours, because it doesn't matter if they're in China at this point.
So how does this work? I've had a really nice time this evening. Could we go into quarantine for 2 weeks so I could kiss you goodnight?
Well, and I think it's honestly, it might actually force people to slow down and pay attention to what's really important, right? Conversations and learning something about people.
Because certain things are off the table.
Certain things are off the table, and it's really about conversation. But it might be nice to get dressed up during this time and actually sit down rather than being in your sweats all day long and not brushing your hair, you know, your teeth. So that's one good thing about it. But really trying to do something in common. Some of the people were saying that they have kind of like made food together virtually, baked a cake together virtually. So they were doing something and talking at the same time. It took a little bit of the pressure off. And it may be, if the date went well the first time, maybe you send some groceries to their house, some cheese and crackers, a bottle of wine or whatever, saying, you know what, we can't share this together right now, but I hope you enjoy it. So there are ways that you can actually do it and start to build a relationship virtually. And I'm thinking that some of these relationships might actually be stronger in the end because it came from who you really are, not who you're trying to impress when you're just across the table with someone and you've had a few drinks.
And I'll tell you what, there's no distractions. You won't look at the waitress or somebody out on the dance floor because there ain't none. So you're right. I think you'll focus on who you're talking to. I will have to tell you, though, I am so glad to not be in this cohort for sure, because I've had all the cohorting I need to do, and I'm glad it's all way far behind me at this point. Until tomorrow, remember, you've been listening to Simply Money here on 55 KRC. We are the talk station.